the sixth lecture and final lecture in the series is going to cover what I call the Inklings period. And the Inklings period refers to that famous literary group of friends, the Inklings. The two giant figures in that were C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien.
Welcome to Faith and Culture, a production of the Augustine Institute. Every week, we explore the glory of the Catholic faith and the beauty of Catholic culture. And now, here's the host of Faith and Culture, Joseph Pierce.
Hello, I'm Joseph Pierce, and welcome to this Faith and Culture podcast of the Augustine Institute. I'd like today to conclude the lecture series we've been doing on the Catholic Literary Revival. This will be lecture six, the final lecture. Just a very quick recap. Lecture one was on the gestation period from the Romantic Reaction under Wordsworth and Coleridge through to the conversion of Blessed John Henry Newman. Lecture two covered what I call the Newman period from 1845, the year of Newman's reception into the church, until 1890, the year of Newman's death, and featured poets such as Gerard Manley Hopkins. Lecture three was the decadent interlude, or the decadent period, the period of the 1890s, where we see how the French decadents under Charles Baudelaire, Paul Verlaine, and Georges Colhuismans crossed the channel under the patronage of Oscar Wilde, and how that generation of English decadent writers, Oscar Wilde, Ernest Dowson, Lionel Johnson, John Gray, Lord Alfred Douglas, and the artist Aubrey Beardsley, how all of these were received into the Catholic Church. We talked about sort of a culture of prodigal sons who returned to the arms of Holy Mother Church after a life of debauchery, and how the unsatisfying nature of a life of self-gratification is depicted with great power in those French and English decadent works. And then lecture four was the Chester Belloc period, the period where the giant figures of those two great friends, G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc, straddled the decades from 1900, the year in which Oscar Wilde died, but also the year in which G.K. Chesterton was first published. So if you like, Wilde hands on the baton of the Catholic Literary Revival to Chesterton, until Chesterton's death in 1936, looking at the influence of Chesterton and Belloc on that period and on other converts to the faith, such as Maurice Baring, Robert Hugh Benson, and Ronald Knox. And then lecture five, the last lecture, was the Wasteland Generation, which is a sort of a subset of that Chester Belloc period, which the two major leaders were in poetry was T.S. Eliot, and in fiction, in the writing of novels, was Evening War. And we mentioned about how, again, they converted to Catholic Christianity as a reaction against the wasteland, the desert, the vacuity, the hollowness of modern and postmodern life. And other we touched upon briefly other writers, especially Graham Greene. The sixth lecture and final lecture in the series is going to cover what I call the Inklings period. And the Inklings period refers to that famous literary group of friends, the Inklings, who met in Oxford twice a week, once a week in C.S. Lewis's rooms in Magdalen College, where Lewis taught, and once a week in the Eagle and Child pub, which they called the Bird and Baby. And how they read their work to each other, critiqued each other's work, talked about literature and other things. This great club or friendship or fellowship called the Inklings. And the two giant figures in that were C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. Other figures were on the periphery, Charles Williams, for instance, Owen Barfield, these other significant figures. Roy Campbell, the Catholic convert poet, was also occasionally attended Inklings meetings. But the two giant figures are definitely C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. So these two giants will form the basis of our final lecture on the Catholic Literary Revival. Let's begin with Tolkien. So Tolkien is what I sometimes call a cradle convert, by which I mean It's neither a cradle Catholic nor a convert in the fullest sense of the word, because he was received into the church as a child because of his mother's conversion. So after his mother converted to Catholicism, she had both of her sons baptized. So he's what I call a cradle convert. But he was raised as a Catholic. His mother died young. Tolkien was convinced his mother died as a direct consequence of the persecutions she suffered following her conversion from the anti-Catholic members of her own family. So when she died, she left her two sons, John Ronald Reuel Tolkien, whom we know as J.R.R. Tolkien, and his brother Hilary. She left her two sons under the guardianship of Father Francis Morgan, who was the Oratory Congregation in Birmingham, which had been established by Blessed John Henry Newman. So one thing that Tolkien has in common with Hilaire Belloc is that both of them were educated at the Birmingham Oratory School, which was established by John Henry Newman. In Belloc's case, because he was older, born in 1870, he actually was at the Birmingham Oratory School when Newman was still alive, an elderly, aging Newman, and Belloc has memories of this elderly figure. Of course, by the time that Tolkien was being educated there, Tolkien was born in 1892, Newman had died, but many of the oratory fathers there knew and remembered Blessed John Henry Newman. So we can still say that Tolkien was raised in his education in the shadow, the benign shadow, or the benign light, if you prefer, of Blessed John Henry Newman. So Tolkien remains a lifelong practicing Catholic. He wrote some marvelous things about the Blessed Sacrament, a very mystical Catholic. But he was a lover of mythology, a lover of story, in particular stories of Northern Europe. So the Norse myths, the myths that came from Iceland and Scandinavia, and Anglo-Saxon myth. So he translated, for instance, the Anglo-Saxon epic Beowulf. And it's this northernness, but very much a Catholic northernness, which informs Tolkien's work. So perhaps we'll do some lectures merely on the Hobbit or the Lord of the Rings at a later date on the podcast. But suffice it to say now that the Hobbit is in many ways can be seen as a meditation on St. Matthew's Gospel, the words of Christ. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So the dragon sickness in The Hobbit, which not only dragons are afflicted by the way, it's not just Smaug who's afflicted by the dragon sickness, but hobbits and dwarves and men also. The dragon sickness is when one becomes possessed by one's possessions. In other words, that we become so obsessed with our physical possessions that they really take over our lives and distort and poison our ability to grow in virtue. So the Hobbit is really about overcoming that dragon sickness of possessiveness and materialism and learning to live more fully, which means learning to live more virtuously, which means learning to live more self-sacrificially, which is why the Bilbo Baggins' journey and leaving the comfort of home and the creature comforts that can be found in the home and embracing, instead of this comfortable numbness, a life of suffering and painful adventure where powerful and necessary lessons are learned. So that, again, a profoundly Catholic work without any overt references to the church. This same technique, if you like, is continued in The Lord of the Rings. And whereas the dragon sickness, what was the overarching evil, the power of the ring is really exerting the same sort of darkness and evil in The Lord of the Rings. Because again, the thing possessed possesses the possessor. So when we possess the ring is in fact possessing us, just as when we have our treasures, our material treasures like Smaug the dragon in The Hobbit or Bilbo Baggins in his Hobbit Hole, that these treasures become our precious. Okay, they actually possess us in a, literally in a demonic way. So it's overcoming the power of the ring, and the ring is destroyed on March the 25th, which is the Feast of the Annunciation, also the traditional date of the crucifixion. So there's a connection that Tolkien draws between the power of the ring and the power of sin, in the sense that on March the 25th, through the Annunciation, through the incarnation of God, and through his death on the cross and resurrection, March the 25th, crucifixion, Annunciation, March the 25th, destruction of the ring, that sin and the ring are destroyed on that significant date. And so Tolkien, in doing this, makes the ring synonymous with sin itself, and therefore the power of the ring can be seen as the power of sin. There are many other things we could say about Christ figures in the story, such as Frodo as the ring bearer, who's therefore the cross bearer, as Gandalf, who dies and is resurrected and transfigured, as Aragorn, who is the true king, has the power to take the paths of the dead and the power to release the dead themselves from their curse, reminding us of Christ's descent into hell following his crucifixion. So all of these figures, and every man figures such as Boromir, Faramir, Gollum. So a work which resonates and palpitates with powerful lessons for us. And it's not surprising that in his essay on fairy stories, that Tolkien should say that fairy stories hold up a mirror to man. In other words, they show us ourselves. And in that sense, these so-called fairy stories or myths or fantasies, whatever word, whatever label you want, are works of high realism because they show us reality, including the reality about ourselves. Could say much more about Tolkien very briefly. I would recommend there's a volume, a slim volume, which contains what I call the essence of Tolkien's philosophy of myth. In other words, the love of wisdom to be learned from the power of story. And the book is called Tree and Leaf, and it contains Tolkien's allegorical short story, Leaf by Niggle, and his poem, Mythopoeia, and his very famous lecture or essay on fairy stories. And those three things together, for anybody who really wants to go deeper into understanding Tolkien's Catholic understanding of storytelling, need go no further than those works. But I'd like to proceed now to a discussion of C.S. Lewis. And Lewis, when Tolkien first met him, was an atheist and a very anti-Catholic atheist. But through the friendship, well, through the influence of Chesterton, Lewis said that when he first read Chesterton's essays when he was in the trenches during World War I, he fell in love with Chesterton's goodness and his sense of humour and became, if you like, a devout reader of Chesterton. And then when he read Chesterton's book, The Everlasting Man, Lewis, still an atheist, says he saw the Christian outline of history laid out before him for the first time in a way that made sense. So Chesterton was certainly a significant influence upon Lewis's path to Christ. But another influence was his friendship with J.R.R. Tolkien. And so when they first met, Lewis was an atheist. Lewis then became a theist, so he believed in God, but not a particularly loving God, and certainly not the Christian God. And then there was what Lewis called the long night talk with J.R.R. Tolkien and their friend, mutual friend, Hugo Dyson. And this happened on September the 19th in 1931. And this long night talk was on the nature of myth, in other words, the nature of story and the power of story. And in the course of this, Tolkien said that Christianity was the true myth, in other words, the true story. He said the true myth, the myth that really happened. In other words, that whereas we write our stories or tell our stories with our imaginations, that God tells his story with history, with facts. And of course, the greatest story he tells is the story of his own entering into the story in the incarnation. The greatest story ever told within history is, of course, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So Tolkien expounded upon this and how this made sense of all other stories, and all other stories, if you like, gained their strength and their vitality from this one true story. And this had such a profound impact on C.S. Lewis that within a few weeks of that long night talk, he was declaring himself to be a Christian believer in God. So it's something which is the power of friendship that that we have up to a degree to thank J.R.R. Tolkien, not just for his marvelous works, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings and others, but also for helping C.S. Lewis to become a Christian. Because if Lewis had not become a Christian, which he might not have done if he hadn't known J.R.R. Tolkien, we would not have Lewis's own marvelous works. And so I'd like to spend the rest of the lecture talking about some of those. Lewis is, of course, known for fiction and non-fiction. We'll begin with his non-fiction. Perhaps, arguably at least, his most important work, his most influential work, is the book that was published as Mere Christianity, which was a rational defense of Christianity. Like Chesterton and like ultimately the Catholic Church as a whole and St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, Lewis insisted on the inextricable bond, the indissoluble marriage between fides et ratio, between faith and reason. And this was a large part of Lewis's work, was to show that that Christianity is rational, not irrational, and indeed that atheism, agnosticism, relativism, these were the truly irrational beliefs of the age. So in Mere Christianity, he shows that, and other books such as The Problem of Pain, Miracles. So we have this aspect of Lewis, Lewis the teacher and the preacher in works of nonfiction. But he was also a fine writer of fiction. His earliest work in this regard, apart from his poetry, poetry of course is not fiction, his early literary works were actually poetry. But then shortly after his conversion, he wrote a book called The Pilgrim's Regress. And this is a formal allegory in which the everyman figure, who also in some ways is an autobiographical depiction of the young Lewis himself, who's called John, it's his journey from Puritania to Mother Church. So from a puritanical understanding of things to a fully Christian understanding of Mother Church. And that story, on the way, he meets various characters who represent certain ideas that Lewis had to tackle and learn from and react against and rebel against and reject in order to get to Mother Church. And these include the Mr. Enlightenment, so the spirit of the Enlightenment, the spirit of Romanticism, the spirit of Classicism, the spirit of Nietzscheanism, National Socialism, Marxism, all of these modern isms, all these modern ideas that he has to confront, be affronted by, and ultimately he's released from a terrible monster called the Spirit of the Age by a beautiful woman in shining armor on a horse, and the woman's name is Reason. So reason defeats the spirit of the age, and we're told that reason's younger sisters are philosophy and theology. So this understanding of Lewis's approach through the embrace and engagement of reason from being a non-believer to being a believer. And then other works, the Screwtape Letters, in which he puts himself in the place of a devil's advocate and shows how, if you like, the devil and his minions, the demonic powers, might try to cause people to fall and falter in their path to Christ. The Great Divorce, which certainly influenced in part by the works of George MacDonald and certainly Dante, a story of those condemned to hell who are, if you like, are given a chance to repent and for the most part refuse. And you have his Space Trilogy, three science fiction novels, and then, of course, the famous Chronicles of Narnia. And could say much more about those. And again, perhaps that might be the subject, a topic of another Faith and Culture podcast in the future. But suffice it to say that a profound Christianity permeates all of Lewis's fiction. So his final work of literature, Till We Have Faces, he considered to be his greatest work of fiction. I tend to agree. It really is a deep, somewhat difficult, and not necessarily most accessible of his works of fiction, but certainly worth the effort of those who read it, and really shows the challenge that the non-believer has to face when a loved one has a religious conversion. That's basically it's a study of the psychology of a need love, which is not really a love at all, a possessiveness towards other people and towards another person, and how that and how we react being so possessive when that person has a religious conversion and if you like leaves us behind because we can't share in that conversion. So the final period then of the Catholic literary revival is the Inklings period. And if you like, the revival ends on a high, ends with a bang. T.S. Eliot famously said at the conclusion of his poem, The Hollow Men, "This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but a whimper." Well, the Catholic literary revival, I don't believe it's ended. I think we have a new one happening here. But this particular golden age, if you like, of a Catholic revival in literature that begins with the romantic reaction against the Enlightenment in 1798 and ends, shall we say, with the death of J.R.R. Tolkien in 1973, a period of almost 200 years, 180 or so years, is a golden age in culture, a golden age in civilization, certainly a golden age in literature. And what's very interesting at the end of this period, we find if you were to look at the list of the top 10 best-selling works of literature of all time, then in the top 10 would be both The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien and The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis. Just hovering just outside the top 10 would also be The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien. So at the beginning of this Catholic revival in literature, the Catholic Church had almost been extinguished as a cultural, political, religious, spiritual force in England. By the end of it, it was not only now at the center of all that was best in English culture, but also at the summit in terms of the greatest works and the most popular works in the English language, in the huge success of J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. And so thank you for joining me, not just for this Faith and Culture podcast of the Augustine Institute, but for the previous five in this six-part, six-lecture series on the Catholic Literary Revival, which we now conclude. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm Joseph Pearce, and I have been your host at this Faith and Culture podcast of the Augustine Institute. Goodbye and God bless.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Faith and Culture with Joseph Pearce. Faith and Culture is a production of the Augustine Institute. For more information, please visit us at faithandculture.com.